We're making our way
Making
through the different eras of church history, and we're winding our study down. Tonight is part eight. Next week we will finish with part nine. And tonight we're going to be talking about some things from 1914 to 1989. So we will be more familiar, I think, with some of the events and issues that are going on during this era of time. And then, of course, next week, when we talk about 1990 on into the future, these things are contemporary, and we see them being in process. So when we looked at this topic, we picked these divisions of time kind of randomly. You can divide them in other ways, but I think they all have kind of a theme to them. And tonight we're going to talk about some of the different ideologies that have developed in this last century and impacts that it had upon the church. So I've been giving to you the date range as well as the definition of the era. And I've also been giving you a picture that kind of defines for us what the century looks like. And on this picture, you'll see a lot of war. And that is really the definition of this past century, is a lot of the violence, a lot of the struggles militarily and politically that are going on around the world. It does have various impacts upon the development of the church. And so we'll see those intersections in a moment. I've also been giving to you some turning points from the previous session, just so as we have kind of some momentum as we get into new material. So last week we talked about the French Revolution a little bit. The rights of individuals is being emphasized. The Catholic Church is trying to preserve its old order, and they come up with a couple of different doctrines that try to preserve the old order. One is the Immaculate Conception of Mary, and the other is the infallibility of the Pope. And we see during this era of time, there is, from the Enlightenment, some awareness of various things that are wrong in society. And in England, under Wilberforce, we see some pushback being started on the institution of slavery. This is an era where Protestant missions is growing, evangelizing different countries with significant individuals that are kind of at the head of that. We talked about some of the different missionaries that went into different parts of the world last week. Then we talked a little bit about, on our own shores, a second Great Awakening that came about. We talked about some of the different individuals that were a part of that second Great Awakening: D.L. Moody, Charles Finney, some various individuals like that. Then we also saw the start of Protestant liberalism that understood that a living faith also needed to be meaningful to the era that we are living in. So Protestant liberalism is trying to connect to the modern world, to science and other developments that are happening. So that's kind of a quick thumbnail of our study from last week that leads us into tonight. So by way of introduction, in the 20th century, struggle is at the heart of everything. Communism, Nazism, and Americanism are kind of in the center of this particular study that we're going to look at tonight. Where does all the stress come from? Well, the control of the economy, the racial tensions that are taking place among people around the world, and the desire for human rights. And what we see is that these churches of that era have to endure a lot of international hostilities that are taking place. So at the height of the Enlightenment, the hope was that the world could be freed from superstition and from the over-authoritative religious order. But by the end of the 20th century, we see that this is According to historians, the 20th century is the most violent century in human history in terms of human casualties and the loss of human life. So you'll see why I say that in a couple of moments. So what we're going to talk about tonight as we begin is some of the developments of these different ideals that are starting to come about in the post-Christian era. What we find is because of science and the Enlightenment, the Christian church has kind of taken a back seat for a while to nationalism, communism, and individualism. These seem to be the three big things that are working. And I think what another thing to keep in mind here is these are ideals that arise out of secularism. The emphasis of being freed from the constraints of church and God. And it will lead up to the 60s when there's a proclamation that God is dead. What's interesting about these ideologies, though, is they take on kind of a religious nature of their own. There is this idea of loyalty and allegiance. We often call it patriotism. That's found to the particular country that's in the midst of some of these conflicts. There's also class struggle that's taking place. This will be the era in which certain people are considered superior to others. And secular humanism is the desire to create meaning apart from God. What we will find is that in the midst of defining who is in and who is out, and leaving God out of the process that all people are made in the image of God, what we are going to see is that secular humanism leads not to more peace and prosperity, but to more loss of life. So that's kind of what's ahead of us here in the next few moments. And I think I'm going to be able to show you that some of the things that we might know a little bit about does have an intersection with the church as well. So when we look at this particular period of time, we're going to first see that this century will have to deal with its first world war. And I don't know if you know anything about what sparked that, but the spark came back in 1914. When there was this Serbian nationalist that assassinated the Prince of Austria-Hungary. And following his murder, Austria-Hungary inflicted a blow upon Serbia, and that began to kind of divide Europe. Russia was in support of Serbia, still is, while Germany was in support of Austria. And this polarization in Europe is going to pull different nations into the conflict and pull them apart as a cohesive continent. Before the war is over, there's 27 nations that are caught up in the conflict. And now we see that people in different countries are going to have to make sacrifices for the war effort. And so a lot of civil liberties and personal possessions are sacrificed to advance the war effort. It's interesting that both sides, it doesn't matter which side of the conflict you're on, both sides kind of felt that they were in the right, as often happens within world conflict. It's interesting that President Woodrow Wilson said that the war was to make the world safe for democracy. Well, it's interesting how we get into these conflicts and we always throw the word democracy and freedom around as a justification. But you'll see there's a big price that is paid. There is a million American soldiers that are engaged in this battle and helping allies to bring Germany to what would become the Paris Peace Conference. Out of this, though, President Wilson secured the creation of the League of Nations as a way of trying to get along, and hopefully that would be the last world war. It wasn't, obviously, but I ran across this little chart here that I think is helpful. The causes of World War I, you can use an acrostic mania: militarism, building up strong military forces, alliances between different nations to protect one another, nationalism, pride or devotion in one's country, imperialism, when one country takes over another country economically and or politically, and then assassination. And so the assassination of the Austrian Ferdinand is an impetus. It's probably the spark. There's a lot of other powder keg issues, I think, but at this point, this assassination justified retaliation. So how did that affect the church? Well, up to this point, you'll find that the church is trying to wrestle with the advance of science, the advance of the Enlightenment. At that level, it is a theological, philosophical battle that is going on. All of that seems to kind of come to a stop because all of a sudden now, the amount of money and the loss of soldiers and people in the war is going to cause the church to put that on pause for quite a while. So it's not a theological battle that's going on, it's an ideological battle. And of course, that intersects with the church, with some of these ideologies want to leave God out in the cold. And with that, everyone kind of does what is right in their own eyes. So, with the evolution of Darwinism as well, we find that again, only the strongest survive. And that seems to be a characteristic during this period of time. So, do you have any thoughts or questions on this lead into church history? There's not much church history in these couple of slides I've showed you, but it will intersect in just a couple of moments.
I thought it was the assassination of the Tsar that started the World War One.
Happened in Sarajevo, in Bosnia.
This is I don't know who you're referring to off
The
top of my head.
Tsar Alexander, I think, and
Russia
his
Tsar?
family that were assassinated.
Are you thinking of maybe is that a part of the Russian Revolution?
It's Russia, but it
It's
had something to do with World War One, I think.
a Serbian guy killed Archduke Ferdinand from Austria-Hungary.
So I think who you're thinking of is there's a lot of other issues that are going on within individual countries as well. Obviously,
Okay.
we don't have the time to be able to trace all those things out,
No.
but you are,
Okay.
yeah, there's a lot that's going on, as you'll see here in a couple of more moments.
Oh, Lenin
Yeah.
gets the power when they
Yeah.
kill the Tsar.
Right. I think you're, yeah. So Leslie, we'll get to that. She said that kind of comes hand in hand with the reign of Lenin as well. So here's where this is going. So you would think at the end of World War I and the amount of life that is lost, that the world would turn toward a better direction in trying to resolve conflicts and minimize hatred and murder and all those type of things, but it doesn't because of the rise of this individual here, Adolf Hitler. The Nazis are a group of people that are a part of an effect upon the church as well. So here we see, excuse me, Adolf Hitler. Actually, he wasn't German, he was Austrian. And he was named chancellor on January 30th, 1933. But it doesn't take him long before he gains control of the government. You'll see here up at the top of the slide here that some of these Protestant churches get caught up in this political movement that comes to be known as the German National Socialism. And what we find is that there is this nationalism and this idea of we are a superior race that's kind of built into this. So look at the bottom of this slide here. Hitler thought that the unity of the German people could be accomplished by eliminating those that were inferior. Down here we have listed Jews, gays, disabled people. Gypsies were a part of that group as well, that are trying to be eliminated with the goal of unifying the German people and making race kind of the central issue. And so Hitler begins this all-out assault, and what we find is it leads to this, the Holocaust. And during this period of time, I think we are most familiar with this death camp in Auschwitz that led to the extermination of 6 million Jews. And they became the scapegoats of a lot of the problems of society. And so these Nazi death squads would take them to concentration camps. Here's a picture in the background of what it looks like. These are individuals that are seeing the smoke of the gas chambers that are rising up in the air. And I can't imagine the horror of being taken into this camp, knowing that your end is in sight. And so it's a terrible, terrible time. And what we find is that these are victims of kind of a racial hatred that will then lead to the church either acquiescing and accepting it or pushing back on it. And that's where we're going with this. So, what did the Christians do in Germany under the reign of Hitler? Well, they began to think of themselves as really no more secure than the Jewish people. And what you find is that there was pushback on different components of the church. So here you see Hitler signed a concordat with the Pope to guarantee freedom for religion and the practice of Catholic worship. And Hitler no sooner gets into this deal, and he then backs out of it. And then he begins to put a prohibition upon Catholics from being a part of the German political system. And on the Protestant side, Christians are watching this, and they begin making closer and closer ties with the Nazi regime. And there's actually 28 different regional Protestant bodies that are united under the leadership of this guy named Ludwig Mueller. He was an individual that was a fervent Nazi. And so you see the Protestant church beginning to kind of protect themselves by just showing their support of Hitler. And they are individuals that adopted, unfortunately, the Aryan paragraph, which basically said that they were the superior race. Within this, though, the church had some great leaders that came forward. One of them was by the name of Martin Niemöller, and he formed what was called the Pastors' Emergency League. And he formed a church government called the Confessing Church. He is an individual that spelled out his convictions of staying true as the people of God in a declaration called the Barman Declaration back in 1934. And he's basically trying to call German churches back to the centrality of Christianity and its beliefs, and to reject this totalitarian push by the Nazis. He was harassed by the Gestapo, and the Confessing Church also kind of led a perilous condition as well. They often had to go underground. There was many of its pastors that were arrested during this period of time. Some of them were even executed, and here's one of them. His name is Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Bonhoeffer lived from 1906 to 1945, and he was one of the founders of the Confessing Church. He was an individual that wrote a lot, and he talked a lot about costly discipleship. He talked about, the community of the church and the importance of helping each other and those type of things. And he was an individual in his writings. He was a very young man, brilliant, brilliant man. And he was an individual that finally said the church has got to do something to bring down this madman, Hitler. And so he got involved actually in a scheme to have Hitler assassinated. And he was an individual that would eventually be arrested. He would be put in prison for a while. And then he was condemned to execution. And on April the 5th, 1945, he was hung on the gallows. He was hung at this concentration camp in Flossburg. And he was an individual that was a victim of bad timing. He was executed 2 weeks before the Allies actually took over. And if this would have happened 2 weeks later, his life would have been spared. So he's an individual that was executed because of his stance. But his writings, even to this day, are absolutely amazing in terms of costly discipleship and what it takes actually to count the cost to be a follower of Jesus. Some thoughts? Anybody have any comments? So let's come back to the Catholic Church for a moment. So back in 1935, the Nazis kind of created their own Ministry of Church Affairs, and they claimed that they were the true fulfillment of Christianity as a justification. But Pope Pius XI in 1937, you can imagine, in light of all the pressure. Now, I got ahead of myself with the previous slide because Bonhoeffer is not actually executed until 1945. However, the pressure that's going on and the courage of this priest, this pope, he wrote an encyclical that is translated with deep anxiety. And he put out the command, for a lack of a better word, that this particular encyclical should be read on Palm Sunday in every Catholic church. And he was talking about resisting the cult of the superior race and the state. And you can imagine Hitler reacted furiously to this because it was being read in every Catholic church throughout Germany. And so he kind of is an individual that stands courageously on the Catholic side, like Bonhoeffer and Karl Barth did on the Protestant side. So any comments or questions there? So you have some heroes on both sides. It's really trying to preserve the church from being taken over and manipulated by the Nazi regime. So meanwhile, there's a Russian Revolution that begins, and there is a group known as the Bolsheviks or communists that take over. And here you have a picture of Lenin. And his real name, I might need some help from Esty here, Vladimir
Ilyich
Ilyich.
Ulyanov.
Say the last one again.
Ulyanov.
Yep. 1870 to 1924. He believed that the chief tool of Marxism was violence, and violent he was. If you thought Hitler was bad, he took it another step. And you can see some of the characteristics that mimic even Hitler's leadership, dictatorial leadership, single centralized party, terror, propaganda, censorship, controlled economy, and hostility to religion. He creates this very disciplined communist party, and he seeks to control this new government through the machinery of the communist party. In 1927, Joseph Stalin becomes dictator, and he also is a ruthless individual that also developed the use of secret police and labor camps to suppress any dissent. So here, the communist revolution in Russia is challenging Christianity because the communist party is based on atheism, not theism. And what takes place is here you can see a picture of Stalin. Joseph Stalin, as you see on this slide, is the dictator of the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, and we're more familiar with it as USSR, from 1929 to 1953. So that's a pretty long period of time. Under Stalin, the Soviet Union was transformed kind of from a peasant society into an industrial and military superpower, but he really did rule by terror. And under his regime, there were millions of different citizens that died. So you have these two leaders here that play an important part in the Russian Revolution. Well, meanwhile, you have the Russian Orthodox Church. It was the state church before the revolution. But when the Bolsheviks took over, they began confiscating church land, canceling subsidies and civil marriage, and they're decreeing civil marriage rather than sacred marriage, and they prohibited religious education. The Orthodox Church, Russian Orthodox Church, reacts with this defiance against the regimes in power, and it kind of spills over into various cities in Russia where there were riots that began to take place. In the first 6 years of this revolution, more than 1,000 Catholic priests were killed. That's astounding. 1,000 priests were killed. By 1939, you have propaganda, anti-religion laws, and so forth under Stalin. And the church is almost at the brink of disintegration. But again, Pope Pius the 11th, he keeps issuing these encyclicals. And so we looked at the previous one here, which was with deep anxiety. And then he writes another one, and this is even more bold. It's called Errors of Communism. So, I mean, it is just straight out against the Russian government. He's sympathizing with the people. And he's offering Catholicism as kind of an alternative to the people rather than life under communist regimes. It's interesting to me that the communist revolution challenged Christianity, and it kind of ebbs and flows a little bit. It comes back to a surface after Lenin and Stalin with Nikita Khrushchev in 1959, where he starts to persecute the church there as well. The confiscation of property, though, is something to behold. Here's a picture. Take a look when the political regime comes in. And of course, these churches are beautiful. They're covered with gold, and you've seen those type of churches in places throughout Europe, and they're basically taking it as spoils of war, as a for lack of a better description. They're taking down crosses and taking the gold and stripping it and that type of thing. So it is a real rough time, obviously, for Christians during this period of time. So it affects Judaism under Hitler. It affects Catholicism. It affects Protestantism. It affects the Ro Russian Orthodox Church as well. So, I mean, that's pretty significant. And you can see why the church is just trying to survive during this period of time. They don't have time for, side issues of doctrine. They're just trying to hold on for their life at this point. Thoughts, comments? So then we come to World War II. So World War I was bad, and here comes World War II, and it breaks out in 1939 when German forces invade Poland. Hitler is not alone, though. He makes a pact with Mussolini's fascist regime in Italy, and a compact as well with this militaristic ruling party in Japan as well. So now we see these nations again are desiring expansion. Usually there's control of resources that are always involved in these type of things as well. And the German church again does not push back hard on Hitler as at all. And what takes place is more bloodshed, more alliances, and a bloody era of time that is memorialized around the world in various ways. And to see what happens here is heartbreaking, and I can imagine our grandfathers who fought during this period of time. They could never get over it. It seems as though those who were part of World War II or the Korean War that comes a little bit later, you understand why many of them they just find their camaraderie in, morning breakfast at McDonald's, retelling the stories and their survival. And it's quite something that I will not fully comprehend because I've never had to go through it. But those of us who know, who've had relatives who have, it's something I think that is embedded in their very fiber of being for their whole life. So, I will say one thing. The church in Russia really struggled under Lenin. Stalin, when he comes to power, did see the church to be a useful force of organization. So he lets up a little bit on that, but he's still in full control of it. As you know, the atomic bomb, the first one that is used, was dropped on Japan and really drove them to the peace table. And of course, the combination of Allied forces will topple the Third Reich. And from that point on, you have kind of what has been called the Cold War, up until the time of the fall of the USSR and they're splitting apart, and the destruction of the Berlin Wall between East and West Germany. So, any thoughts, comments on any of that? You can see here in the background the picture of Hitler, and I think we've all seen various pictures of World War II. And get a little bit of a sense of what it felt like. But
Any thoughts or comments, questions?
My great grandfather in Germany, he would write letters to the family over here, and he would always close with something about God. And we know the letters were open, but I guess he was so old they didn't bother him. But it was just like, oh my gosh, you have the nerve to.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
And then
Do you
my,
still have those?
yeah, that's how I know, because
Oh, okay.
they're, yeah, Dad had some letters. And then my grand, his parents left in 26 before all this stuff happened, because there was such an inflation over there, and they knew there was something going on, so they said, we're getting out. So.
Very good. Thank you. All right, we'll forge ahead. So on this side of the pond, what's taking place? Well, after the turn of the century, there were the evangelical church is still has its presence, and these American evangelicals are individuals that are going to begin to push for coming back to the roots of the fundamentals of the faith. And so they're kind of fighting not only all the violence that's going on in the world, but they're fighting also against science and fighting against some parts of the Enlightenment that they feel endanger the faith. This is an interesting comment. This historian, George Marsden of Notre Dame, compared evangelicals in the 20th century to rootless immigrants in a new land. They're trying to find out how to engage with the culture. It has changed. The country has changed dramatically. And so they're going to begin to concentrate on a lot more end time scenarios. Here's where you're going to see a lot of what we might call eschatology take place. In fact, the idea of Jesus coming back soon in light of all that's going on in the world leads to the doctrine of premillennialism, that Jesus is going to come and set up his kingdom on earth. And they began saying the world's getting so bad, Jesus' return has to be imminent. And so a lot of the doctrine that has come out of this period of time really concentrates on prophecy, concentrates on the return of Christ, a lot of the things like the Great Tribulation, Antichrist, a lot of these things kind of start to take shape during this era of time. And you can understand why, considering everything that's going on around them. So what do? So they begin to print out these things called the fundamentals of the faith. So you can see here on the slide, from 1910 to 1915, they published and printed 12 of these small books that are called the Fundamentals. And their design was to defend the fundamentals of the faith. And they sent these small little booklets out to theological students, ministers, missionaries around the world. They're trying to get their influence into the hands of influencers. And it was all underwritten by a guy by the name of Lyman Stewart. He was an oil man that lived in Southern California, and he underwrote the publication of these and sending them out. What's interesting is Stewart enlisted the support of his brother to get this thing happening. And his brother's name was Milton Stewart, and he was one of the pastors of Moody Church in Chicago. If you were ever to go to Moody Bible Institute in Chicago, some of these names would be familiar. because some of the buildings are named after some of these individuals. So a guy by the name of R.A. Torrey was the one that did a lot of the editorial work on these pamphlets that were being sent out. There is a building on the campus of Moody called Torrey Gray Auditorium, and that's where I walked across the stage and received my diploma in Torrey Gray Auditorium. And that's from this individual who did this editorial work. Moody, Sankey, Torrey, some other individuals all played kind of a significant role around the turn of the century. And you'll see these pamphlets had 64 different authors. So it had a wide spread of different theologians, but most of them were evangelicals. And so what you find is the name of these publications were called The Fundamentals, or The Fundamentals of the Faith. And from that comes this idea of fundamentalism, the belief of certain doctrines. World War One rather, kind of delayed this this conflict between fundamentalists and modernists in the theological arena because of the wars. The war of words kind of heat up as the wars come to an end and focus begins to come back to certain doctrines. And these are the doctrines that are at the core of this literature here, the authoritative revelation of the Bible, the sinful nature of man, the inability of man to be saved apart from God's grace, and the centrality of Jesus' return. So a lot of these things that are going on here is coming back to a lot of the arguments of the early church. Some of those individuals that we talked about, Council of Nicaea, Council of Chalcedon, a lot of those things that we talked about in our earlier sessions. But they're going to have to deal with one big one. And the big one is because of the popularity of Charles Darwin, his discoveries of evolution. And it leads to a thing called the Scopes Trial. Here, 1925, there is a man by the name of John Scopes. He is a teacher in a Tennessee school, and he began to teach about the theory of evolution. Here's a picture of him. Let me take this so you can see what he looks like here. Looks like a typical type individual teacher in the 1925s, bow tie, that type of thing. He actually is being accused of teaching from a book called Civic Biology. And that particular book, Tennessee wanted to be prohibited in schools because it included a chapter on biological evolution. What's really fascinating, though, is that in that book, Civic Biology, later in the book, it turns out to be pretty racist, because when you talk about evolution, there are some species that survive and thrive and others that are dominated. And so we would think that this this book is quite racist if you read it all the way through. But it becomes the focal point of a trial. And there's two individuals that are in the midst of this trial. One is a guy by the name of Clarence Darrow. And he's the one that is defending John Scopes for his teaching of the theory of evolution. Another individual, he was the prosecuting attorney. His name was William Jennings Bryan. And Bryan really does lose the trial. Darrow runs circles around him. And what we find is that in 1921, this guy, William Jennings Bryan, had issued a series of attacks on evolution, which kind of put him kind of in the middle of the conflict. So it was natural to put him in the courtroom. Well, Bryan's primary concern was not so much the theory of evolution, but the consequence of it. And that is, if we teach the theory of evolution, then it could have an impact upon democracy, and that the strong could ultimately take advantage of the weak. So the trial goes on, and Scopes, John Scopes, is found guilty of breaking Tennessee law, and he is fined a whole $100, which he appeals. And the victory, though, really came for Darrow, because he was a brilliant individual, and he argued for the intellectual freedom of the country, and that students should be able to learn about the theory of evolution. So the way I put it here at the bottom of the slide is, although Bryan won the trial, Darrow won the country. And so from that, then, we see that evolution still is being debated throughout the decades. And I think personally that a lot of this type of thing has led in more recent years, it'll be part of maybe next week's lesson, is to homeschooling, protecting kids from some of these things that parents don't want them exposed to, that type of thing. Some thoughts, comments? So now you're seeing how a lot of the social stress is interplaying with the church. Do you see that connection? There's a lot of issues that are going on. So here's what happens. There is now an effort to renew what we called evangelical Christianity, which we talked a little bit of in previous lessons as well. So after World War II, Moody is off the scene, George Whitefield is off the scene, but there's this guy by the name of Billy Graham that comes into the spotlight. And Billy Graham was just a phenomenal communicator. And so he would start these different crusades and so forth. And he had the vision to communicate Christianity also with things like Decision Magazine. He helped the launching of Christianity Today magazine as well. He is an individual, as you can see by the picture here, that was very, very demonstrative and charismatic. And he was an individual that caught the attention of the nation. I think only in recent years have we seen that he also had a lot of political connections as well. He was an individual that was in the White House for a lot of different presidents. And so there is a wonderful element to this. There's also some things that I think, if we would wish it to be done differently, that maybe this merging of religion and politics might not have happened as much as it is today, if maybe we could have been a little bit more careful back then. But during this era of time, there is the development of Pentecostalism. And it goes back really to 1906, when there's this street mission in Los Angeles called the Azusa Street Mission that had a three-year revival that continued, and it caught momentum. And the idea of Pentecostalism was obviously the Holy Spirit engaging people, and that experience is seen through the speaking of tongues. And really, it's the Azusa Street revival that sparked many of the different Pentecostal denominations. And even all the way up into the 60s, you see Pentecostal influence starting to make its way into mainline denominations. I remember I was working at the East Ohio Gas Company between semesters of school, and there was a lady that worked in the office there that she was a very devoted Catholic. But during the 1970s, late 70s, when I was working there during the summers, between semesters, there she was getting attracted to the Pentecostal influence within the Prismatic Catholic Church as well. So I kind of saw some of this develop a little bit firsthand. I was new to the faith. 1975 is really kind of when I gave my life to Christ. But it is that same era of time that Pentecostalism is going into a lot of mainline denominations, like Presbyterianism and Lutheranism and Catholicism and that type of thing as well. But here's what the Azusa Street Mission looked like here. This was one of the headlines, Pentecost Has Come, from one of the papers in 1904 out in Los Angeles. And we occasionally will see these revivals that will take place. You know, there's one that was recent that was happening down in Kentucky that lasted for a number of months from students that was on, was at Asbury, wasn't it? I'm trying to remember. I think it was Asbury Seminary. And so occasionally you'll see this type of thing happen. Well, this is what prompted a lot of Pentecostalism. But I want you, the reason I chose this picture, do you see what's on the side of this car here? Jesus is coming soon. Get ready. Again, apocalyptic type of elements because of all the other things that are going on in the world. They believe Jesus is coming at any time. Back when I came to faith, that that same emphasis was in the church as well. In the 1970s, with the publication of the late Great Planet Earth and those type of books, lent itself to a lot of prophecy obsession and the belief that Jesus was coming imminently. So some thoughts there. So that's what's happening on this side of the pond. But around the world, it's interesting what's happening in the church. The ecumenical movement starts to take place. Now, ecumenical basically means universal. And there's this attempt at unity across denominational lines. And it goes back to 1910, where there was a missionary conference in Edinburgh. And it led to what would eventually become the World Council of Churches. And here you see a long table of some of the prominent members that established the World Council of Churches. It actually comes into existence formally in 1948 in Amsterdam. And it was an attempt to try to get along across church lines. As I mentioned earlier, the church is just simply trying to survive at this point. And they saw this of great value to not argue about minor differences or even if they are substantial doctrinal differences, there's a greater call to work together for the betterment of the world. And with that in mind, the Roman Catholic Church is trying to modify itself as well. And we find that they call another Vatican, Vatican I, basically established a lot of the dogma of the Roman Catholic Church. Well, Vatican II is called, and this is, as you can see here, a conference that's held over a number of years, from 1962 to 1965, this is held. And they are changing their image a little bit. So Vatican I is kind of using the image of the church being a fortress. And we're going to survive the attacks of secularism and modernism and all this type of thing. They began using the idea of pilgrimage, that the church are pilgrims, and they are to move through this world, and they are to care for the weak and the weary. But this Vatican, even though it has some changes that comes to it, it's really not a council called to combat heresy. It's not even really called to give new dogma, but they are trying to update, if you will, the church to the modern world. So what they do is they update the liturgy. It no longer has to be done in Latin. It can now be done in the vernacular language of people. It gave a larger role to lay people who are lay ministers, readers in the mass, those type of things. They start to do a little bit of dialogue with other world religions as well. So after Vatican II, you have kind of a reforming of the liturgy, worship liturgy. And then there's an emphasis on the importance of family. And they try to foster a spirit of respect. So probably if we've lived long enough to see this, what was more adversarial between Catholics and Protestants prior to Vatican II starts to ease up a little bit. And again, let's bring Billy Graham back into the picture here. He was criticized heavily for being on the same stage with Catholic priests and those type of things, which it's this effort of trying to get along that is beginning to be a part of the movement of this era of the church. So we've covered a ton of stuff. Do you have some ideas, some thoughts, some questions that I can attempt to clarify? Anything? No? Okay, so
you did cover a lot of ground. That's the course.
Yeah. No doubt. And you could sit and camp in any one of these for a long period of time to get the full range, really, of the effects that it has. My idea here is primarily let's get a bigger understanding. Let's get a big picture idea of how the church has gone through different eras of time.
It's interesting how the evangelicals back in the day were extremely negative toward the World Council of Churches. It was they were almost viewed as like the great Satan or something like that.
I think fundamentalism in general, of which evangelical movement is a part of that, they were very weary of crossing any type of lines other than people that believe like we do type thing. And I do remember this because, that's a bad movement, the ecumenical movement. But it was an attempt to try to unify the people of God across the different various denominations. But you're right. There was a lot of pushback on that. Anything else tonight that you'd like to talk about?
It's a little scary how much, pre-World War II reminds me of right now.
Yeah.
In the same lines that we're going.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's nationalism, all these type of things that we are feeling at the heat of right now, especially this year being an election year, mm-hmm. it's going to continue to be, felt really each week until the election. Sure.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
We also watched an interesting movie the other night. We watched it because it said it was time travel, which it did have in there. But it's called Time Changer, and it's about a professor of a seminary from the 1990s that travels forward, or from the 1890s that travels forward to about the 1990s, and is extremely shocked at what he sees and how he's, preaching to get back to where he was. It stars Gavin MacLeod, believe it or not.
Oh, Captain Steubing.
Yep. But I mean, it's just.
What's that on? Is that on Netflix? What'd you watch it on?
Do you remember where we watched it? Let me take a look here.
What was it? What was the name of it, Shelley?
Time Changer.
Time Changer. Oh, sounds interesting. Okay. I'll have to see if it's on Netflix. Yeah, very good.
I can't remember where we watched it because I was looking for something to watch one.
Well, keep an eye out for it. Sounds good.
It was interesting.
Very good.
A little over the top.
Well, that's why we watch
Prime
it, right?
Video has a, and we must have watched it on Prime.
Oh, okay. All right. Very good. All right. Well, thanks for being a part tonight, and we will see you again next time, okay?
Thanks, Larry.
Thanks.
All right, you're welcome. Good night.
Bye.
Night.